Major funding for The Pulse is provided by a leadership gift from the Sutherland family. The Sutherlands support WHYY and its commitment to the production of programs that improve our quality of life.
This is The Pulse, stories about the people and places at the heart of health and science. I'm Maiken Scott. There are about 19 million veterans in the U.S. who have served in the armed forces. For many, the military gave them a sense of shared purpose, a strong connection to their comrades.
They gave me a community that accepted me as long as I could do the required tasks. And it's all laid out. It's very clear.
We worked together so much that we didn't even need to speak to one another.
But that community often disappears when they get out of the service.
There's none of that. And the big cliff drop for me was, well, now who am I?
If you think about it, 19 million veterans is less than 10% of the adult population, about 1 in 10.
It's a very small percentage of people that have served in the history of our nation. There are moments where you just feel like the only person that's gone through these things.
Feeling alone or misunderstood.
That veteran that's sitting to their self, isolated, or irritable. They're not that way because they want to be.
So what do veterans want other people to know about their experiences? On this episode, veterans share stories about their lives, their health challenges, and how they're pushing forward and creating community. Our first story comes from a combat veteran, Ray Christian.
I served in the Army for more than 20 years.
Ray is now a writer, a storyteller, and a podcaster. He uses the VA system for much of his health care, and he noticed that most of the vets he sees there getting services are men. So he wondered, what's the experience like for female veterans? He asked one of them.
My name is Jessica Ian Jenkins, and I was in the Army, served in the Army National Guard, South Carolina Army National Guard.
Jessica was a communications specialist in the National Guard from 2002 to 2008. She shared her story with Ray of feeling ignored by the VA system, not getting the help she needed until it was almost too late. It all started when Jessica's unit was deployed to Iraq in 2003. Here's Ray.
What was the nature of that deployment? What was your mission?
Our mission was to establish tactical voice network and internet for that particular area that we were in, and it was a hostile. It was very hostile.
So even though Jessica was not in a combat unit, she wasn't a rifleman or a machine gunner, she still saw a lot of combat.
It's just the experience of being there and coming under live fire, coming under, we were attacked with 75 millimeter to 150 millimeter mortars, rockets, grenade launchers. They would hold up in a mosque and they would fire on us every day. So that was very traumatic.
Do you think that people realized the level of contact you were having, part of a support unit?
No, I don't think they did. Because we were always told that if we went to war, that we would never be in a place where we would experience combat, but that was a lie.
Seeing combat meant seeing combat casualties and people getting hurt.
A couple of people was injured. There was a guy in my unit that was injured, and he was a cook, and it was fortunate that he was in the defect at the time, standing behind a stove, because a mortar round landed like right outside the wall of the defect, and the building was made out of aluminum, so shrapnel just ate it up. But fortunately, the stove caught most of the shrapnel, and he caught like four or five pieces in his body, and there, like four of them are still in his body till this day.
The cook was lucky, relatively speaking.
And there was another girl, there was a mortar that landed right outside the door. She was getting ready to run out to a bunker, and it caught her in the leg. And I just remember her screams. I can still sometimes hear her screams, but that, and it was just terrifying. I mean, it was, yeah.
While you were still serving, active, deployed,
mm-hmm.
What impact did that have on you? Emotionally,
it was tough, but while I was there in that moment, I didn't have time to feel those emotions, so everything hit me afterwards. But it took a toll on me. It took a big toll on me.
Jessica couldn't bring herself to talk about any of this while she was still in the Army.
It wasn't really discouraged, but people would talk. You know, they look at you as like damaged goods or something because of some effect. Besides, you're part of the strongest, baddest fighting force in the world. So that is a sign of weakness. And that was my mentality also, you know, and then also too, coming from an African-American community, you know, there's a stigma against mental health anyways that need to be dealt with. But you aren't going to tell me anything's wrong with me. I mean, I just went through something that normal people don't go through, but I'm going to be fine.
After she returned from Iraq, Jessica participated in a military training exercise in North Carolina, which ended up being a powerful trigger.
And so it was sand, it was brown, it was dusty. They had simulators going on, artillery rounds going off, smell of sulfur going. We was firing blanks in our M16s, and there was burnt cars. They had been exploded by IEDs. So I went through that, but when I came home, I ended up losing it almost. It took me back to a place, and all those feelings that I had once coming back home from my original deployment, they came back full force. So around the beginning of January, my friend came and was talking to me and was like, Jessica, you really need to seek some help. But see, I wasn't trying to hear that.
Her friend took her to the VA, actually several of them. But Jessica says the staff didn't take her seriously.
They really weren't doing anything. They didn't get me any help or anything. They just kept pushing pills on me. It's like there's no urgency about what I'm going through.
One of the things that I have found over the years that I've done work with women veterans, that it wasn't designed for women. It was designed for men.
That's Ann Cheney, a public health researcher at the University of California, Riverside.
They're really focused on providing for a particular kind of veteran, and that veteran, by default, is a male veteran. And so it's a space that women aren't always, they're not always welcome. And, you know, like a common thing is they might be considered to be the spouse of a veteran, for instance, rather than the veteran themselves. I think when it comes to combat for men, it's a given. It's default. Oh, you were in combat. Of course you experienced trauma. There's still disbelief that women have been in combat, despite the fact that they have been in combat, and that's seen specifically within the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan.
Jessica continued to try to get care for her mental health issues. She wanted counseling, but that was never mentioned as an option for her. She was frustrated.
I've yelled at people, you know, had screaming matches, you know, with people.
So imagine that you are a vulnerable patient population. The staff around you may or may not believe what you're saying. You're experiencing ridicule from other male veterans as you walk down the halls of this VA healthcare system. You get catcalled, and then you have to advocate for yourself in a bureaucracy where people likely are saying, call this number, go here, go there. It's a place where you can just get lost.
Jessica's emotional state continued to decline.
I was extremely angry. I couldn't be dealt with. A lot of people couldn't deal with me. They couldn't really talk to me. I was irritable. I always wanted to isolate myself. I cry a lot. Depression. There was a lot of depression. Like, I don't have a purpose. Nothing matters.
Jessica attempted to take her life.
I went to church that morning, and I came home, and I said, you know what? I'm done with this. I'm done with life.
But she didn't die. She drove herself to the emergency room.
Told them what I did or whatever, and they, you know, they helped me. They gave me some medicine to, you know, to get rid of the nausea and the headache and stuff. So, and they let me take a nap.
She called her friend to explain what happened. Her friend was furious and got on the phone with the VA.
And she said, and I lit into them. She said, I lit into them. I said, okay. I got calls from the VA. Like, four different people called me that morning. They signed me up for group therapy. They signed me up for counseling. And they put me on their high risk for suicide list. And I got calls from them from the rest of the year, actually, every week. And I never really had any more issues with the VA. That was it.
Anne says one part of the solution is simple. Listen to female veterans. Ask about their experiences. So I did.
What is it that people don't understand about veterans?
I don't think they really understand the impact of our experiences and the toll that it has on our lives. We sacrifice a sense of ourself. We sacrifice ourselves, our whole being, you know.
What would you want people to know that you think they know the least about?
I think they know the least about how a traumatic experience, war, affect us. That veteran that's sitting to their self, isolated or irritable, you know, they're not that way because they want to be. Something happened to them, what they experienced.
Jessica and I talked about our common frustrations and that of other veterans long after the initial interview, with the kind of familiarity and unspoken acknowledgement of two combat veterans.
What do you miss the most about military service?
The camaraderie. I miss my soldiers. I miss the camaraderie of it. The coolest thing about us, I love about us, you know, you tell somebody that you're a veteran, or it's like you never meet a stranger. We just start talking, you know, that's the coolest thing about us.
That story was reported by Ray Christian. He's a veteran and a podcaster. His podcast is called What's Ray Saying? The Veterans Health Administration provides care for millions of veterans at VA health centers across the country. When you talk to veterans, they'll often mention their frustrations with the VA. Lots of bureaucracy, tough to get appointments. But there is another side to this massive health system. The VA is often a trailblazer, leading the charge in telemedicine services, introducing things like integrated physical and mental health care records, or developing new treatments for brain injuries. And now researchers in the VA system are digging into health inequities and why veterans with access to the same care are having different outcomes. Utibe Essien is one of these researchers. He's at the VA Center for Health Equity Research and Promotion in Pittsburgh.
And I study cardiovascular disease disparities.
In some ways, studying health disparities in the VA system is easier than in other settings. Usually, access to care and health insurance are huge factors, but not here.
Patients receive the same access to care. So the same medications that are prescribed in one VA are prescribed in another, the same cost of medications.
It doesn't matter if you are in Pittsburgh or Houston or Atlanta. But despite this framework, disparities exist. Utibe is a physician in addition to being a researcher, and recently he's been looking into atrial fibrillation treatments.
Atrial fibrillation is the most common heart rhythm disorder in the U.S., affects about 6 million individuals here. And over the last decade, the VA has actually cared for about 1 million patients with atrial fibrillation. And it's an irregular heart rhythm where your heart feels like it's beating differently from normal. And the biggest problem with atrial fibrillation, other than that discomfort, is that it can cause stroke as well as death. And so my research focuses on how do patients have access to the medications that actually prevent strokes.
Utibe found that patients of color at the VA did not have the same access to newer medications that are more effective in preventing strokes. Now, in the VA system, how is that happening? Because you said earlier, you know, technically every patient at every VA has the same access to the same medications, right?
Exactly. So that's really what surprised us when we dove into these data and found that racial disparities existed. Because coming into the VA, I've now worked here for about 3.5 years, a lot of the data were suggesting that we did not see the same disparities as we see outside the VA, that hypertension was better managed in the VA and other cardiovascular diseases.
How big were the differences that you were seeing within the VA when it came to prescribing these newer medications?
Yeah, so we found somewhere from a 24 to a 25% lower chance of getting these newer medications for Black patients compared to white patients. When we looked at Hispanic patients, that difference was about 20%. And when we examined American Indian and Alaska Native patients, again, they had about a 25% lower chance of getting these newer blood thinner medications.
And are the newer medications better? And if so, how?
Absolutely. So the reason I actually dove into this area of research is that over the last decade, these newer medications, they're called direct oral anticoagulants, or DOACs. They are much more effective at reducing strokes. So these medications reduce stroke by about 70%.
Uthibe says you also don't have to worry about interactions with other medications or maintaining a specific diet, which is the case with older medications. So why are not all patients receiving the newer medications? Uthibe recently got a grant to figure that out.
Our approach is to interview doctors, interview veterans, and really get into what's going on in the clinical spaces to try and understand why these differences exist. Let's think about the historical legacy of racism and discrimination and how unconscious or implicit bias might affect the way that we treat patients. Let's think about what's going on in VA1 versus VA2 in terms of patients' comfort around accessing these therapies. Let's try and understand what a patient understands around a new treatment. Do they think it's an experimental drug or not? And again, that's why I'm really excited to get into these interviews to learn more about patients and doctors thinking around these treatments.
Uthibe Essien is an assistant professor of medicine at the University of Pittsburgh and a researcher at the VA Center for Health Equity Research and Promotion. Over the years, there's been a lot of education about the lasting health impact of military service. Traumatic brain injuries, PTSD, lost limbs, or substance use disorders. But one injury that's not getting as much attention is damaged hearing.
The tinnitus is the worst when everything is so quiet. You're really trying to concentrate, trying to focus on something, and all I hear is ee!
That's Dave Scheibel. He spent 20 years in the military. He served in Iraq, Afghanistan, and Kuwait. And the deployments led to severe hearing loss over time. Liz Tung talked to Dave about how it all happened and how it has affected his life.
Dave's hearing damage is severe. He uses hearing aids most of the time. But even so, he struggles. There are certain pitches that he just can't hear. The worst is when he's trying to talk with someone in a crowded place, like a Starbucks.
So when I ask somebody, hey, can you repeat yourself, you know, for the second time, you know, it could be a third or fourth or fifth time, and then you can see it on their faces that they're disgusted, they don't want to repeat themselves, and the facial expressions, you know, tell a million words. Sometimes you just kind of want to hide yourself and just really not go out into public because, you know, you just don't want to really talk to people in general.
Dave first joined the Army in 1998. He was just 19 years old and had always known it was something he wanted to do.
My dad served 20 years in the United States Navy and he retired as a chief. Watching him succeed and watching other service members defend this great nation, I felt like I wanted to be part of the team.
Dave was pumped to be there. He was excited to deploy, to get in the middle of the action. But pretty quickly, he figured out the toll that combat would take on his body and his mind.
We were in Afghanistan, and we had an explosion right in front of me. It was so loud and so horrifying that it's just really hard to describe. We lost two good men that day. If I was just a few feet more, or if I was in that vehicle, I wouldn't be sitting here talking to you. But it was so loud, so horrific, and it felt like it went in slow motion.
Dave says it's not that the Army doesn't try to protect soldiers' hearing. He says just about every branch provides hearing protection devices. The problem is not everyone uses them, at least not all the time.
when we're getting shot at or when things happen, we can't just go tell the enemy, hey, cease fire, you know, wait till we put our hearing protection in. Things are going to happen suddenly, and we can't help that.
Sometimes after firefights, Dave's head would ring like a bell. But he didn't realize just how bad his hearing had gotten until he tried out for the Special Forces, something he'd had his eye on for years.
The Special Forces recruiter says, hey, I really want you on our A-team. However, you failed your hearing test. You need to go back because I can't give you a waiver. I can't clear you.
So Dave took a second hearing test. But again, the audiologist said, no dice. And then she told Dave something that shook his world.
You'll probably be separated out of the Army within the next 5 years, and you're non-deployable. And that's how I realized this is a very severe issue.
Dave was devastated. His whole life was centered around the Army.
I remember thinking to myself, well, what do I need to do next? And how am I going to go about it? Am I ready to get out of the military? Am I going to disappoint my dad? Am I going to disappoint everybody that looks up to me?
On top of all that, at the time, Dave was going through a horrible divorce. The last thing he wanted was to sit at home while all his buddies deployed. So he volunteered for another tour and made sure that this time his damaged hearing wouldn't stop him.
The funny story is, I didn't get cleared to get deployed. The lady who was stamping the form turned her back. I stamped it and I left quickly. And then I turned my paper in and said, okay, yeah, we're leaving on this day. It's like, okay. So I was like, bye. Yeah, that's probably one of the most illegal things I've ever done. But
it ended up being Dave's final deployment. These days, Dave works as an advocate for veterans with hearing loss. He says he can understand how they feel.
You just feel so isolated from the rest of the world because, you know, folks with any type of disability, they always feel like they're different. No one's going to accept me for who I am. No one's going to really care about me, or no one is going to want to talk to me because they have to repeat themselves 9 million times.
There's no cure for profound hearing damage. And Dave says a lot of veterans are too proud or too ashamed to use things that could help them, like hearing aids. On top of that, the military doesn't give much compensation for hearing loss. All of it adds up.
They feel worthless. They feel like they're a failure. They'll feel like they're not worthy enough. People make fun of them, and that's where we have to intervene and say, hey, look, you know, you got to stay busy. You have to maintain a mentality and find something to do, whether it's, you know, take your kids to the park or, you know, go somewhere and just enjoy yourself, enjoy life.
Even so, there are still things that Dave really misses. The sound of nature, of birds chirping, of the ocean crashing on the beach. And more than anything, the sounds his two-year-old son makes.
And I get scared a lot because now that I have an adorable little guy in this world, you know, I don't want to miss out. And I feel like as he gets older, the more my hearing is going to visually deteriorate. And so I'm going to miss a lot of the things that he says or... And those are some of the things that I worry about later in life.
That story was reported by Liz Tung.
Support for The Pulse comes from Select Greater Philadelphia. With over 30 cell and gene therapy development companies, Greater Philadelphia is where the field started and continues to thrive. More at discoverystartshere.com. The Commonwealth Fund supports The Pulse and reporting on health equity. The Commonwealth Fund, affordable quality healthcare for everyone.
This is The Pulse. I'm Mike and Scott. We're talking about veterans and their health. Finding your place in civilian life after service is a challenge for lots of people.
When we're in the military, we're constantly tested and evaluated to make sure that we're fit for service. But when we got out, I didn't feel like we were in any way, shape, or form given a manual or trained or given any form of assistance to make sure that we're fit for society.
One veteran had an idea to help others with this transition, and it involves Shakespeare. Nicole Curry has more.
In 1991, Stefan Wolfert was mentally done with the military. He was an infantry officer and a medic in the Army. Two soldiers in his troop had died by suicide, and another died in routine training.
When that funeral took place, I lost it.
His grief overwhelmed him as he handed a folded flag to the family and thanked them for their son's honorable service. But the words leaving his mouth no longer made sense. He left the funeral, took a train nowhere, yet ended up somewhere.
I'm on an Amtrak heading through Montana into the mountains.
After climbing on top of the train to admire the night sky, he jumped off, landing in a small town named Whitefish, Montana.
I started wandering around and wound up going into a production of Shakespeare's Richard III.
The play began. The actor playing Richard walked on stage, giving his speech.
Now is the winter of our discontent, made glorious summer by this summer.
And the lines seemed to speak to Stefan.
That's what I needed. I was really good at the military, and now I'm pretty sure that my military service is over. So now what?
Stefan left the military 1 year later, unsure what to do next.
What do I do? And what do I do with all this? With the way I respond to loud noises? I'd been wired to respond to a threat with violence, and now I've got to use my words that I was never trained with?
He headed to grad school in 1997 to study Shakespeare. It just seemed to be really helpful to him.
I was able to redirect my anxiety, my PTSD, my ADHD, my alcoholism. So like any practice, it became a way to not only help me on stage, but off as well.
2 decades later, he started a program called Decruit, designed to help veterans using Shakespeare. Craigman Bauman, an Air Force veteran, enrolled in the program in New York.
I got to release a lot of things that I was holding on to from years prior.
At first, he wasn't sure it was a good fit.
When I was a kid, I had to read Shakespeare in public school. That was the worst experience of my life. It makes you feel stupid. Until I was told, okay, and let's read it anyway.
The first thing we do is ask, what are your thoughts and feelings that come up? And then we ask them to read one line at a time, breathing inward before each new line.
And I did that. And it softens, just that breathing in between each line, it softens the read. And as the read softens, as you almost melt into your own breath, because you inhale and you exhale on the read, so it's almost like I'm not even reading it, I'm breathing it. And at that point, meaning starts to flood in that I'm not even trying to create.
To be or not to be, that is the question. Oh, right. Kill myself or not kill myself. Whether 'tis nobler in the mind to suffer. Yeah, right. Should I just be suffering in my own mind or whatever their interpretation is?
The first couple of lines that I was just reading in a group of other veterans and I started bawling. Oh my good Lord, why are you thus alone? I didn't have my footing on a path that I felt comfortable walking as I transitioned out of the military. I was confused. I was overwhelmed. I felt that the military doesn't only issue a uniform, it also issues you an identity that doesn't matter once you're out of uniform, an identity that no one sees before my blackness, and the sense of aloneness came from all directions.
Stefan and Decruit participants met weekly to read Shakespeare and write their own poetry. But eventually, he wanted to see if science could prove their results.
And then Alisha Ali at NYU approached us and said,
can we understand the effectiveness of Decruit from a scientific perspective?
Alisha Ali is an associate professor in the Department of Applied Psychology at New York University.
And so the reason that Shakespeare's verse works is primarily because there's a rhythm there, the iambic pentameter that mimics a human heartbeat. And it's very important for the veterans when they start Decruit to sort of immerse themselves in that verse and feel that rhyme and rhythm. Because what it does is it gives them a sort of structure where at the end of each verse, they breathe.
Or to take arms against a sea of troubles.
Thoughts tending to content flatter themselves.
And by opposing end them to die to sleep.
You know, it's really incredible how, you know, when any of us experiences something traumatic, we just tend to do a more sort of shallow breathing. And that kind of breathing gets in the way of you vocalizing. Then here comes Shakespeare with this elevated, heightened language that not only captures their experience so accurately, but uses language that opens up a different world.
I can deal with the world a little better because of Decroot. First of all, it's kept me living. It's kept me living. That's the first thing. And then beyond that, it's a community that I'm a part of.
I have been studying how I may compare this prison where I live onto the world, and for because the world is populous, and here is not a creature but myself. I cannot do it, yet I'll hammer it out. My brain, I'll prove the female to my soul.
That story was reported by Nicole Curry. Coming up, Zachary Bell wanted to connect with other veterans. His method, a cardboard sign, a marker, and some inside jokes.
Drink water, take Motrin, and change your socks.
He posts his messages on Instagram, and his page is now being followed by thousands of veterans. That's next on The Pulse.
Behavioral health reporting on The Pulse is supported by the Thomas Scattergood Behavioral Health Foundation, an organization that is committed to thinking, doing, and supporting innovative approaches in integrated healthcare. WHYY's health and science reporting is supported by a generous grant from the Public Health Management Corporation's Public Health Fund. PHMC gladly supports WHYY and its commitment to the production of services that improve our quality of life.
This is The Pulse. I'm Mike and Scott. We're talking about veterans and their health. Zachary Bell was an infantry rifleman in the Marine Corps. After getting out of the service, he often felt a sense of isolation. He wanted to find a way to connect to other veterans, and he decided to go back to the basics, a piece of cardboard and a marker. In March of 2020, he made a sign and posted a picture of it on Instagram.
There's this very old military medicine remedy where they always tell you to drink water, take Motrin, and change your socks. And that was what I did because I was talking about COVID. Because it's really literally what you're told to do for anything, especially while you're in active service.
And why cardboard? I mean, it's sort of a funny medium in this world where everything is like so polished and so pretty, especially on Instagram.
Yes. I mean, I think that's it exactly. Everything is filtered, screened, you know, colors are balanced. And I was really kind of thrown by this juxtaposition of low technology on a high technology platform. I think about it as like an infographic. Like, there's something I want to tell you, but it might not just be the words. It might be how I'm dressed or where I'm at. But, like, you have to look at the picture, and I want the layers to be there.
His Instagram is called Veteran with a Sign. In most of the photos, Zachary is wearing sunglasses, a backwards baseball hat, and a military green T-shirt showing off his tattoos.
The first month I did it, most people really didn't understand what I was doing. And to be honest, I probably didn't understand either. I was really trying to trigger a feeling of nostalgia and have people like build like a healthy community online.
The Veteran with a Sign Instagram page now has more than 86,000 followers, and other veterans have started to submit their own messages. Many are lighthearted and funny.
I joined for the discounts.
Are you hurt or are you injured?
Your silent drill team still makes noise.
Some feel like inside jokes for people who have served.
Chili Mac is the best MRE.
If I was a SEAL, this would have gotten me a book deal.
I never want to be derogatory. I don't feel like that's helpful, but I always say, like, how will you know that I was in the infantry? Just wait, I'll tell you. And so, like, I'm poking fun of myself as much as I'm poking fun of everyone else.
But among the jokes, Zachary includes more serious messages.
Text your buddies.
We can disagree and still be friends.
Suck it up doesn't mean you can't ask for help.
I think in particular with military service or any type of, you know, service, you know, if it's nonprofit or otherwise, that you have these really life-changing experiences, and there's some bonding that happens. I think that comes from just service to others in general. There's a quote, I can never remember who says it, but we find the best version of ourselves in the service of others. And after you're done, it just kind of scattered to the wind to all the different corners of the country. And, you know, I had noticed feelings I had, you know, transitioning out of the military. And, you know, it started to come up again, especially during the quarantine that everyone was in. And I was like, well, what if I made like a healthy online community? Like, what if I was able to get people to laugh more and hurt themselves less? And that was like the initial idea of it. You know, since leaving active duty, I've lost more people after the war than I did to it. And I just have felt this like recent resurgence to like tap back into these things in this community, because like, you know, there are moments where you just feel like the only person that's gone through these things, especially after military service. You know, people just feel alone and it's hard. And you have to find ways to process and move through that. And for me, it's been doing this, because I look at it as all like a big creative writing project. If I tell people every day not, you know, not to kill themselves or, you know, work on what they're doing, it doesn't really seem to resonate as much as if I pepper that in with, you know, jokes about, you know, trying to find Humvee keys, which there are no keys, and things like that.
What were some of the challenges you had when you came back and when you left the military?
I'm still having them now, if you... I think the greatest challenge I've had is just, you know, it's tough. It's very tough. The war just came to an end after 20 years. And I think people were just a little bit desensitized to it. I mean, I was. I know they were. I think the biggest issue I've had is that, like, it's really hard to find people that are like you. And people, as well-intentioned as they may be, end up, I find, being somewhat insensitive, even though they don't mean to.
Yeah. Like, what are some of those insensitive things? What do people say, or what are some things people shouldn't say?
I remember a few years ago, I was at a local gym. I was just working out, and I have tattoos. I'm well aware of it. I'm okay. They mean a lot to me. I'm going to get more. But there was this older gentleman who came up to me and asked me if I was in the military, and I was like, yeah, I was in the Marines and stuff. And he's like, oh, okay. And just kind of small talk. It's honestly more common than not. And at one point he looked at me and he goes, hey, you don't have any of that PTSD stuff, do you? And I said, well, it kind of comes with the territory. And like, have a nice day. And I just kind of ended the conversation there. And almost everyone I know has an experience like that. In his defense, I did have cami paint on, so I'm just kidding. That's a face camouflage. No, it happens all the time, just like busting into things. The guy who talked to me at the gym, I was honestly just like, I remember feeling like, wow, this guy like cares, that's cool. And then it just took a sharp turn into asking me if I had any of that PTSD stuff. And I'll never forget it, because it was the way he phrased it.
If you have not been in combat, you have not served in the military, but you have somebody who is dear to you and you are worried about that person, what are some good ways to connect to that person? Respecting their experience, but also showing concern and maybe getting them to talk about it.
I think the first step is to meet people where they are, to understand that it's hard. I think the biggest fear is that you'll be judged by these things, and to really just try and start a conversation, you know, just hold space long enough for them to let you in, right? I'm never embarrassed or afraid or don't want to talk about it. That's not the thing. I guess the biggest thing is just trying to overcome that first step.
That's Zachary Bell. He was an infantry rifleman in the Marines. He left the military in 2011. He's the creator of the Instagram page Veteran with a Sign. You're listening to The Pulse. I'm Mike and Scott. We're talking about veterans and their health. James Hatch was 17 when he joined the military.
The appeal was to be a person who could affect change and not just talk about it. I think it was a very important thing for me to be a part of something bigger than myself.
James spent more than 25 years in the U.S. Navy and as a Navy SEAL, conducting dangerous missions in conflict zones all over the world. He shared his story in his book, Touching the Dragon. He was living what he's called a high-frequency life, intense, filled with purpose and pure focus.
We worked together so much that we didn't even need to speak to one another. We had trained so hard and so much with each other that we knew what we were thinking without speaking. We silently went about our work in a really professional and pretty amazing way. And in those moments, you know, I call them, you know, clean, shining edges of time, where there's no distraction. The focus is amazing and it's impactful, and it's very difficult to find that anything even close to that.
James was wounded in combat in 2009 on a failed mission to rescue an American hostage, Bo Bergdahl. All of this became a very high-profile story. Afterwards, James could no longer serve because of his injuries. He was depressed, and he felt a deep sense of shame and failure. At some point, he attempted to take his life. He said therapy and writing the book helped him work through some of those tough emotions. But he still missed being part of a team and that intense sense of purpose.
That was part of my struggles, I think, afterwards, trying to find a place where I felt, you know, like I could be a value added and, you know, accomplish important things.
But he's found that place again in a totally different setting, in classrooms at Yale University. James started his studies there as a freshman 2 years ago when he was 52.
And I can feel that same level of intensity and investment. People here are very invested in trying to fix something, whether it's, you know, hey, I want to go to medical school so that I can do this, or whether it's a very close friend who's an economics professor who's trying to help reshape the way we approach healthcare. And so when you're in that kind of an environment, it's very similar to the one that I was in when I was in the military.
How has it been being a college student? Is this a place where you could have ever seen yourself?
No, there's no way. I mean, there are times I was like, man, at some point, I'd like to go back to college, you know, or go to college. But in reality, you know, no, I didn't. And I was very afraid when I came to Yale. Just because, you know, my academic background was weak at best, and I just didn't know what to expect. And it turned out to be just an absolutely amazing, it's been amazing. And, you know, what's really been shocking to me, because I didn't expect it, was how keen these young people are to hear my thoughts on things. There are so many great examples here of really sharp people who can communicate in what I call a non-blunt force trauma way, which is kind of my MO. So it's really neat to hear my colleagues and my professors as they discuss these issues in a really calm and tempered way. And I'm trying to learn, you know, that from them. And I'm getting better for sure. I still get overwhelmed with emotion depending on the subject.
At some point, it must feel like your experiences set you apart from others, because you've done a lot of things that many other people could never imagine being in those kinds of situations. Did you at times feel like those experiences were a barrier in connecting to others, or have you learned to overcome those barriers?
I think that those barriers exist, and I think they exist because I create them, or people who don't know me but know of me create them for themselves as well, and I think we can all do that. I think what has helped me is not always being on transmit mode, meaning I don't have to push my experiences on people as though I'm some sage that knows something because I was involved in, you know, close combat for numbers of years in different parts of the world. And while it is an intense and dramatic example. It isn't the only thing that's important. There's a lot of other things that are going on that are important. And if I listen more and empathize with the people around me and the things and challenges that they've got, you know, then it seems like I end up being in a better position to contribute because I'm not trying to push my views. What happens a lot of times, with, especially initially after I first came out of the military, is I really felt like I needed to tell people how it was and what, you know, they didn't, you know, they don't get it. And I think that's an unfortunate byproduct of the culture. You know, when you have such a small percentage of the culture who goes out and does these, you know, dangerous things for years and years and years and years, and they feel as though most people don't really care. Unfortunately, because of the way the mess, you know, was organized in Afghanistan, people were detached from it. And I think that was by design in many ways. And so I felt as though I needed to be aggressive with telling people that I served in combat and that I know the real deal. And when in fact, my view, although rare, was really limited. It's been great to come to that conclusion and, you know, to forgive myself for being in that mindset that is totally human and totally acceptable. I mean, certainly I wish I wouldn't have been as, I don't know, self-righteous as I was, but I can give myself a little grace there because of how intense those experiences were.
James said a pivotal moment at Yale came when one of his classmates approached him to tell him about her grandfather.
So this young lady just came up, she just said, you know, it was after a class that we had together, and she said, you know, I was just, my grandfather is a veteran, and he was here, you know, he was in school at Yale, and then the war started, World War II, and he left, and he flew airplanes, and he came back, and he tried to finish here, but he couldn't, he locked himself in his dorm, and he just drank, and he had to leave, and so I feel like I'm here to finish maybe a little bit what he started, and I'm doing it with you, a veteran, and you know, she's this young lady, and the look on her face and how she felt it, you know, she felt what she was saying. You could see it. The sincerity was palpable. It was like the sentiment behind what she was saying. It was really emotional.
Right now, James is part of a class that Yale created after the U.S. withdrew from Afghanistan. The goal of the class is to create an after-action report on what happened with the war and what went wrong for future leaders. It's led by several ambassadors who served in the Middle East and other key participants. James told me being in the class has occasionally been rough. It's brought out his blunt force way of communicating at times. He recently had a heated exchange with the ambassador leading the class, and afterwards, he called his mentor, who is a retired Navy SEAL.
And he said, you know, you need to keep at it. You need to keep swinging. You need to make sure that stuff is understood because you're the voice for those of us that were in that environment. And I just, wow, it was really compelling. And so it's really great to be a 54-year-old guy and be invested in a mission.
That's James Hatch. He is a student at Yale University. He was a Navy SEAL, and he's the author of Touching the Dragon. That's our show for this week. The Pulse is a production of WHYY in Philadelphia. You can find us wherever you get your podcasts. Our health and science reporters are Alan Yu, Liz Tung, and Jad Slayman. Marcus Biddle is our Health Equity Fellow. Charlie Kyer is our engineer. Nicole Curry is our associate producer. Lindsay Lazarski is our producer. I'm Mike and Scott. Thank you for listening.
Behavioral health reporting on The Pulse is supported by the Thomas Scattergood Behavioral Health Foundation, an organization that is committed to thinking, doing, and supporting innovative approaches in integrated healthcare. WHYY's health and science reporting is supported by a generous grant from the Public Health Management Corporation's Public Health Fund. PHMC gladly supports WHYY and its commitment to the production of services that improve our quality of life.